broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed. And everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack of all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are these words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indigent desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. The Second Coming by W.B. Yeats in 1919. Welcome to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Well, I admit that Yeats' poem is not a great welcome, but this appears to be where we are today. This is the second program in our series on truth. My guests to continue the discussion are Don Rush and Adam Wood. Don Rush is Associate Program Director, Senior Producer, News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio. And Adam Wood is Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and the Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Don and Adam, welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me here. I'll say real quick, I speak for none of those groups, though.
Okay. You speak for yourself.
Only for myself.
Adam. Well, I think most often you do. The first session on truth, which aired February 22nd, focused on the nature of truth and the contention that we appear to be living in a post-truth era, a time in which lying is a norm of expression and all facts are considered suspect. Today's discussion continues that theme and looks at how a society and its culture develop in a post-truth world. Another way of stating the question might be, how does the denigration of truth affect society? And how should we respond in a post-truth world? In his little book on tyranny, Timothy Snyder says there are four modes in which truth dies. In each of these modes, he suggests that there is an impact on society. Snyder's book is a political treatise, and his intent is to warn against the development of tyranny at the governmental level. This is important in the current political environment. At the same time, however, the modes in which truth dies has an impact across society, including science, education, work, and the media just to name a few. The first mode in which truth dies, Snyder says, is open hostility to verifiable reality. Now let me repeat that again. Open hostility to verifiable reality. This takes the form of presenting inventions and lies as if they were facts. Demeaning the world as it is, Snyder says, begins the creation of a fictional counterworld. Don, you first, and then Adam, join in, please. Are we already living in a fictional counterworld?
Well, in terms of the kind of thing that we live by, it's probably to emphasize, first of all, we have narratives of our own. We have individual narratives about our own personal experiences, where we grew up, our interactions with, say, with our parents or our friends. We have then community narratives. Do you come from the South? Do you come from the North? Are you African American? Are you Hispanic? Are you from the LGBTQ community, for example? Those create their own individual narratives. So one, first of all, begins with narratives in terms as an individual, but then there are community narratives. And I was thinking about this the other day, and it's almost like when you move from, say, the village to social media. What I mean by that is that the narratives and the norms that you absorb, say, for instance, in an individual village that's just cut off from the rest of the world, or maybe it was, say, maybe 1,000 years ago, those norms dominated what you told about yourself and about your community. As you begin to move, obviously, into the world of print, that begins to expand somewhat, in which there become now the broader ideas of what society is about, which have been lifted away from your own personal experience in the village itself. And as you move into the electronic age, certainly with radio, but then certainly with television, you begin to get something that's artificial and something that you create an imaginary world in which we all identify, even though we've not experienced it. For example, you can, for instance, watch a local television station and its news program, and every night you can see, say, violent crime, you know, some violent crime here and there. Even, and you'll think that violent crime is going up even when it's actually going down. So it's created this fictional, artificial narrative world that you live in. When you begin to then move into social media, you begin to see the same thing occur, but in maybe siloed form, for example, so that we're creating these kinds of fictional worlds for ourselves as we move forward into the 21st century, out of what was essentially an electronic revolution, certainly of the 1930s and 40s. And you think about, for instance, campaign advertising is an example. Campaign advertising was a way to create images. One of the most famous is the Nixon campaign put out a bunch of political ads showing the country is going to pieces, and these violent images of particular groups of people. That created a narrative for a set of voters, a pushback, as it were, from, say, some of the cultural revolutions that were going on in society as a whole. So I think we've already moved into an artificial narrative. We did that probably in the 20th century. Now the question is, what happens when you take it from a place where the state, for instance, dominates everything, or corporations dominate the messages, right, for their own interests, to now the individual kaleidoscopic set of narratives, and how then, particularly for political figures, how they then are able to manipulate those narratives. So now you get, for instance, Russians, a really classic example. So what the Russians did, they didn't like put out mass ads, you know, to try to get the largest audience, right, for whatever they were doing. They micro-targeted their particular ads, their particular messages to particular groups, as indeed campaigns now do. So you can get inside of individuals' artificial, as it were, world, and create more narratives for him to then grasp onto, so that then if you're a political leader or a candidate, you can then pull them into this world that, for all extents and purposes, never really existed before, even though it's based, you know, somewhat on facts on the ground.
Now, before you jump in, Adam, let me ask Don to back up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. You dropped the word silos on us. What do you mean by silos, and what roles do those silos play?
So, for instance, we have a tendency, particularly on the internet and certainly with social media, to say log on to sites that we happen to agree with, right? So if you're a conservative, say, for instance, you might like log on to Fox, and then depending on what kind of conservative, you might be logging on to Breitbart, mm-hmm. or you can go further and further, right? So what happens is that then once you get locked into these very narrow casted worlds that they create, then suddenly you have been siloed in into a particular fictional world. And they can tell you all kinds of things that are like attached to it. So now so instead of getting just simply a mass audience in which you all have some generalized view of the world, even if it's artificially created, now you've got it so it's individualized, so that people can reach inside of an individual's person, you know, world, and in terms of their communities and so forth. So it's almost like Marshall McLuhan, I think, was. It's like reaching in to manipulate the man when he's alone in the crowd. And I think that's exactly what's happening here with social media.
Well, when I have the impression that when I was, and this is in terms of silos, when I was growing up, I grew up in a Southern culture in South Florida, as an example. And now I can look back on that period. And to a degree, I can see the cultural silo, because my identity and my view of the world was impacted by that silo of South Florida that I was in. It had to do with segregation. It had to do with the Southern Baptist Church, evangelicalism, and so forth. So even before, wouldn't you say, we even get to the kind of silos that political campaigns might create for us, that in growing up and in developing, we develop in a cultural silo, in a sense. Would you include that in your description of silos? And what role might that play? And then, Adam, I'm sorry, I'm running on here, but I'll let you jump in.
So the difference between the silo that you're talking about, in which you grow up in a small town, you have this, and you have common values, that's really kind of an organic silo, as it were. Okay? It's not like somebody came in and said, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this, and this is the way you're going to think. It sort of grew out of whatever the culture, whatever the experiences were, the community. What we have now are sort of artificial silos, in which you go to particular websites and create this artificial world, which you then begin to identify with. And the same thing has happened. So when you, it's almost a step forward from the mass artificial world that you would live in, say, for instance, in the age of television in the 1960s and 70s, where, okay, you had broad swaths of people, right? Now you can create an artificial world, not for everybody or for large portions of the segment of the population, but individuals. And that's manipulated, manipulative kind of artificial creation, as opposed to the kind of community you're talking about, which actually organically grew out of people's experiences, people's history, the history of the community, however right and wrong those, by the way, might have been. And I think that's the difference between what is might be an organic silo or organic cultural experience, as opposed to, say, the artificial one that we're looking at today.
It would be interesting, Don, however, to see how the creation of these artificial silos and the creation of this artificial world uses this organic silo that we grew up in. How, in other words, the cultural silo we grew up in, how open that is to the receipt of the artificial implications If I'm being at all clear here,
the content of these silos aren't created out of thin air. The cultural stuff that we live with, particularly the organic kind of stuff, that's the material with which then these artificial creations are made of. So, for instance, if you take an issue like, say, racism, for example, say a racist community, for example, well, you're going to then utilize that to create and shape whatever particular worldview that you want to create, and to use prejudices that are contained in that organic material to then amplify and create another world. And one of the examples may be the issue over immigration and how the president but other people have described the immigrants coming across the border. Those descriptions don't come out of nowhere. They come out of based on some of the organic material that they have in front of them, and they merely utilize them to create then this artificial concept of, well, they're all coming to take away our jobs. They're all trying to invade us. So I think that's where those two meet.
So you might be culturally susceptible.
Yes, right. That's what they do.
In some instance, to
right, right. I mean, they manipulate the cultural nuances and cultural prejudice and ideas of any particular community, and then create a new one.
Adam, the original question
that was about 10 minutes
back a few minutes ago was: are we already living in a fictional counterworld?
I mean, I think fictional is an interesting term in some ways, and I would kind of complicate, I think, what Don was saying, where he was talking about artificial communities, where if a community believes itself to be a community, we can't really call it artificial. But in some ways, I think there's perhaps more of a sense of a virtual community, right? Where as opposed to, before the internet age in which we exist, we do have more of what Don called organic communities, right? That were much more location-based. You grew up in the South, you grew up in New England, you grew up in, the Pacific Northwest, whatever it is, where I think the communities that we're seeing now are fundamentally much more virtually created, right? That, again, as Don hinted at, you think of the extreme right is finding stuff on Breitbart, but we can think of, more leftist politics finding stuff on SlateMagazine.com or Salon or some of those sort of websites, where I think a lot of this connects to redefined senses of identity, right? Where a lot of identity was grounded in location first and foremost. I am, from this particular area, be it the South, New England, whatever it is, and then I might be these other things as well, where the shift now in terms of what is often termed identity politics is an assertion of identity first and foremost. And then I think individuals go and seek out a community that matches that identity, which complicates things in some ways, because there's also sort of a counter argument that says people go looking for an identity, right? And they find some identity online that they think, oh, that sort of matches certain things I think or I feel. But in order to be a part of that community, one has to sort of adopt dogmatically those principles. One of the things that Yeats is sort of lamenting in the poem that you opened up with is that notion of the center cannot hold, right? And for Yeats and for a number of the modernist writers of that period, there was a lamentation of the loss of an idea of Western culture and of Christianity and of a Christian God, right? So that Christian God was the center that seemed to be absent, right? So this is what Yeats is lamenting. This is what T.S. Eliot was lamenting. And they had that sort of sense of there needed to be some sort of course correction, right? We didn't get that course correction. And so I think what we're seeing now is sort of an increased splintering, right? So those silos, the sort of tribalism, and we've talked about this on some of the previous shows, where there is this increasing tribalism where, we might have previously identified ourselves with a specific political party, right? You were a Democrat or you were a Republican, where now, again, the identity issue complicates that. I am of this identity first, right? Be that a racial identity, national identity, sexual orientation identity, whatever it is, but that there are equally rigid sort of political requirements that go with that, I think. And so, again, I think to suggest that they're artificial suggests that they're not out there, which is just not the case. I mean, they're certainly out there, and we see this more and more. And we see it sort of, I think, really being pushed by the extreme political positions on both sides of the fence. I mean, if we think about identity politics, there are far left versions of it, but there are also far right versions of it that use very similar language in terms of, again, as Don sort of pointed out, in terms of creating a narrative. A narrative has to have an enemy, right? That's sort of how ideology works. And then so we have these sort of silos built around that.
I think this, you're taking on the term fictional, Adam, is really very interesting, because I got the sense that what Snyder was saying about a fictional counterworld, he isn't. I don't think saying that it doesn't exist. Right. I think perhaps what he's saying is that perhaps it doesn't comport with the real world that is out there, that the world that we create, this kind of counter world, is a world that does not bear factually with the world that we generally experience.
No, and I think that that's definitely true. I mean, I think that these sorts of ideologies are often grounded in a fiction of some sort, right? So if we think about sort of far right now, the sort of fictional narrative of there's a crisis at the border, right? Are there more immigrants attempting to come into the United States than there were in previous moments? Okay, sure. If we can agree that there's a statistical, numerical bit of fact there, as soon as we put it in the language of there is a crisis, right, constructs that narrative in such a way. And so if we have that as the sort of founding principle of that belief, then everything has to sort of emerge out of that. And so, again, building a narrative around a questionable premise, right, an a priori assumption of, oh, well, this is the case that it's a crisis, right? Anytime you use the language of crisis, the point is to whip people into a fury. And so, you know, sort of how do we address a crisis, right, requires a crisis response. And so the narrative, I think, is built up around that. And again, that I think, you know, the crisis mode is something that is not just unique to the right. I think this is in some ways how culture and politics are working these days, that they are sort of driven by not a disagreement on policy or, you know, even political positions, but rather that there is a fundamental crisis that must be responded to now. And that urgency, I think, can make things often a bit more perilous than we've seen.
In a sense, if everything is political, if there are two people together, right, trying to decide something, politics is at work. But Don, let me ask you if still on this fictional counterworld, look at the world of media just as an example. Have we created a fictional counterworld in the world of media? Can you opine on that? And I guess what I mean by that, and I'll give a very, very simple example in a moment, but in the media, can we believe, for instance, that all advertising is true?
No.
And if what is said in the world of advertising does not comport then with what is real, because they're lying, okay, is that in fact a fictional counterworld that exists in the world of even advertising or in media generally?
Well, I think it's something when I was thinking about this, it reminds me of the 1984 example about doublethink, right? There's two holding two contradictory things in your hand at the same time. And I think the media, I think, oftentimes will reflect this, whether it's an ideology or whether it's advertising or what have you. I mean, you know, for instance, that it's like, you know, you go out, you see something on television, say, well, this is really going to be really neat. You go out and you buy it and you bring it home and, well, it's not so much, right? So now, is what they say untrue? No, not necessarily. It was, but they maybe not told you the entire truth, or the personal experience will be much different than, say, for instance, the actual physical experience. But I think to broaden it out from just beyond advertising, I think we do create a fictional media, a fictional world in the fictional material that we present to ourselves. And we were bombarded by all kinds of, you know, television series and movies and so on and so forth, which have become far more real to us than, say, probably even, say, the written word, say, a couple of hundred years ago, which obviously a lot of people couldn't read. And we absorb those images as part of our own experience, because we're experiencing them. When we watch and we hear the little characters on the TV or the big screen, that now becomes part of our experience. So first, one of the revolutions that's occurred within the last 10 years has been the public attitude towards gay rights and gay marriage. Mm. And one of the reasons, it would appear to me anyway, is that people began to know gay people through these images on television, which were not the traditional drag queen at some outrageous parade, right? But no, they would look just like you and me, and they had these experiences and so on and so forth, and we began to accept them. And all that became part of our own personal experience, even if we didn't know any gay people. It was just part of our experience. Now, there are some other factors involved, but I think that's the way, from a positive standpoint, that's the way this artificial world that they created of novels and so on and so forth
that media created.
Yeah, the media created then become part of our experience, and it shapes in the way we have attitudes towards others. One of the things that's really struck me, as I particularly watched the news, but it's true, I think, of fictional material, is how diverse television is today, as opposed to, say, when I was growing up. I mean, I think MSNBC, I think all the field reporters were women, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, and lots of African Americans, a lot of Hispanics, and so on and so forth. That's going to have an impact on how we view the world around us, the diverse world that we have around us. So, you know, 20, 30 years from now, that the generation particularly that's growing up now will have a much different view of diversity than, say, for instance, my parents might have.
To that point.
To be on an optimistic note. Can I jump in real quick?
Go ahead, Adam, please.
That notion of advertising is sort of fascinating because I think in some ways the news media has simply become advertising in that way. Where we can think, in previous generations in terms of newscast, you would have longer form stories and longer form discussions, where now we get the very, very short 1 minute sort of soundbite about something, which fundamentally functions as advertising. And that I think we see that not only in the news, but in the sort of cultural products that we consume. Working at a university, one of the things that I always think of is that it's fascinating to me that professors in the humanities, the sheer volume of them that drive Subarus is overwhelming, right? Now, is that because Subarus are fine cars? Sure, I suppose they are fine cars, but it's sort of fascinating that we have a product that has connected itself to culture, to politics, to identity in some ways. Are Toyota's fine cars as well, or Honda's fine cars, but that it is fascinating that, I would make an estimate that it's, 70-some% of humanities faculty or liberal arts faculty drive Subarus. That's not a coincidence, right? And so we think about how, does Subaru know this? Do they target their advertising more on, say, for example, MSNBC, than Fox News, right? And I've not done any studies on that, but I'd be willing to bet that there's some truth to that. And so it's sort of interesting. I mean, are we existing in a world in which everything is advertising, right? We think about the decline in the reading of novels, right? Not only has the short story, for example, become a much more popular form, but we think about a form known as microfiction, right? Which are these short stories that are in essence a page and a half. Is that part of the culture that we've emerged into where we are not looking for nuance and detailed thought and expansion? We're simply looking for an advertisement that confirms our assumptions that we already have. And again, I think that's one of the, it has complicated notions of arriving at truth through discussion and debate as much as, well, this is what you believe here. This is fed back to you, purchase it. Right. And so that we consume with our dollars, our very own politics. And it simply reinforces a belief without complicating it really in ways that it needs to be complicated.
I mean, we certainly try to find things that reinforce what we believe, right. which and now we can do that even more so with say social media as opposed right. to when there are only say for instance three television networks. And at the same time, you know, we talk about advertising and its dominance, right? Do you see an ad over and over and over again? And you go to the store, chances are you're going to probably buy that product or one that's been advertised as opposed to one that isn't. Why? Because you've already been introduced to it. It's already been reinforced. I mean, it's the trick of advertising itself, right? And then you get the same thing, I think, with when you start to broaden out to things like news or talk shows, probably a better example, in which you get people gravitate to things that they either are familiar with or mm-hmm. that reflect their own opinions. And I think that's where you get to, again, to this sort of division, dividing up, as it were, right. of the world. So when you look at, you know, everybody, for instance, we have the Mueller report that came out about this, about the Russian scandal. Definitely. Right? And everybody's saying, you know, telling their viewers and their listeners, you know, you really need to go and you need to read this report. Some 440 pages. Most people know that most people are not going to be reading this, that they're going to get it beginning whatever they know about this report from the news clips or what some analyst says, as opposed to actually reading it for themselves and then analyzing it and coming up with their own analysis. And I think that's where you get the loss of nuance. The thing about just short stuff, one of the things that they recognized was that, in particularly for electronic media, you need to be short. You need to present material that's probably not more than about 45 seconds long before you move into the next whatever it is. Right. And it may just be the same story, just a different voice. The reason why they do that is they discovered that the attention span of people shifts up, continually jumps up and down. So it'll jump up with a new voice, and within 40 seconds, it disappears. You know, it's already on its downside. Well, if you're somebody in radio or in television, you got to, like, jump that thing up again. The counterintuitive to this is, of course, Rachel Maddow, who goes on forever, but not with no breaks, and there is a room for that in the media. But so then when you get this shortness, and then Twitter, for example, is it emphasizes that even more, so that you're not able to analyze or taking the time to analyze something that's thoughtful. On the other hand, most people are busy carrying out their lives, right? So that whatever their public opinions are not derived from the private sector or the private portion of their lives, but from the public sector, you know?
Let me push this a little further, if I might. And that is, we began this first mode, and we may not even get to the other three, but we push this first mode with Snyder saying in his little book on tyranny that truth, the first mode in which truth dies, is that there's an open hostility to verifiable reality. And to what sense today are we experiencing in our culture an open hostility to verifiable reality? And rather than politics, I'm thinking of the world of science and the measles epidemic that is sweeping a number of states across the country. Is there an open hostility to verifiable reality, and what impact is that having on us as a culture, perhaps in the world of science, in the world of education, if it exists in the world of education?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think so. I think it's interesting. I can't remember I was reading this. I believe it was on The Atlantic, but I could be wrong about that, where there was an interesting discussion about the disregard for science, right? And we, you know, an obvious example a lot of people might think of is certain conservatives rejecting the science of climate change. right? Sort of saying, yes, well, you know, great that 96% of scientists agree on climate change, but I don't believe it. It's all a hoax or whatever it is. But at the same time, you know, there's this article pointed out that there is a suspicion at time about science from certain left segments as well. And so I think, you know, the science that we accept or that we endorse perhaps is, again, driven by ideology first, as opposed to, science has verified this fact. Science has verified, you know, this truth. That is, if it does not comport to our ideological perspective already, we will disregard it in a heartbeat. And even to the extent of we won't even discuss it, right? Well, that science seems racist, sexist, elitist, whatever it is, that if it does not match the sort of ideology that we're getting in our silos, to go back to that language, that we disrespect it outright. And so I think there has been a growing, at least suspicion, for science as a field in general. Because, again, that sort of notion, again, I think a lot of it goes back to sort of the argument of, well, everything begins from some position of bias. Even scientists are biased. So if they engage their science from a biased perspective, therefore their science is going to be biased, right? And so even verifiable facts that a scientist may discover become suspect in that sort of way. And so, again, I think it's an interesting question where we have seen ideology take the front seat in a number of ways. I mean, I think this is also true in terms of art, right? Where instead of confronting a work of art or a piece of literature from an aesthetic perspective, we approach it from an ideological perspective. If this does not feed my ideological view, it is bad art. And you can say, well, but what about the technical aspects of this work of art? Well, it doesn't matter. That does not accord to my politics. Therefore, I will disregard it. And this becomes very complicated when we look at sort of the history of art or the history of literature, right? I think I was teaching a novel earlier this semester in which a character that today we would identify as a transgender character, great novel by a female writer named Juno Barnes called Nightwood. But that was not language that was in use in 1929 or 1930 when this was published. And I had a student who really sort of struggled with this, and he kept saying, well, but this novel, I mean, this is transphobic, the way that this character is presented. And I kept sort of having to come back, well, historically, that was not a thing. There was not language for that. I mean, that word didn't even really come into usage until the 1970s. And so, again, sort of imposing a current ideological position on a work of art or a piece of literature from the past removes our ability to look at something aesthetically, in the same way that I think approaching science ideologically removes often our ability to look at something scientifically.
Don?
Well, one of the things I was just saying, we're talking about literature. I recently reread Huck Finn, and the general criticism is that it's voracious use of the N-word, which was common at the time. And from a personal standpoint, and I understand why people might find that offensive, but the heart of the book, in terms of the slave Jim, that was the one who actually disappointed me the most, because when Twain describes his character, he's almost childlike, and that really bothered me more than, say, for instance, the use of the N-word. Mm. But, you know, when I read some other stuff by Twain as well, and one of the things that comes through in his novels is that he does have a tendency to look at African Americans through this kind of simplistic lens, which is actually a serious flaw in his writing, but not necessarily uncommon, of course, at the time. I mean, you could read Harry Beecher Stowe did a great job in a number of novels of really sharply defining who these people were. So, but the thing that strikes me is that, yes, our views of the world change, and we have to certainly take into account what the world was like back then and understand, which I think is important. But at the same time, we're looking back and saying, oh, well, wait a minute, you know. If we look, for instance, at the interaction between the Europeans and the Native Americans in the United States, right? Well, you know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, cowboys and Indians. Well, you know, if you look at it now, and it's like, well, it's more like genocidal. Now, right. It may not have been planned out, but that's the way it was. And it was really a terrible sin that we have in this country. So when a Native American looks at this, says, hey, well, wait a minute, you know, and from a perspective of people in the 21st century, they'll look at this and say, wait a minute, this doesn't comport. The other classic example, obviously, are all the Confederate monuments. Same kind of thing. For years they lived, right? Now the country has said, no, we reject what they symbolize, what they represent. And some of the communities in the South are having a very difficult time coming to grips with it. But slowly but surely, those symbols are beginning to disappear. That's a re-evaluation of the past. And I think we're always stuck with that. I think that this constant re-evaluation process, I think is a good thing. And I think in the end, yes, a student may struggle, right, with a particular word or view, and you sort of talk it through to understand, A, what that was about, and then, B, how does that relate to the world that we live in? Just one quick note, because I think I passed it on to you. There was a book written in the mid-1920s about the Jewish community, right? It was basically talking about Austria, kicking all the Jews out. And this really is a very strange novel. But one of the things in the book that really struck me was that it was really trying to address the anti-Semite who didn't really want the Jewish community to exist in Europe. But in essence, it said, but they do all these good things, which played into a lot of these stereotypes that anti-Semites have. So when I look back on it now, I can appreciate what he was trying to do, even though I can also recognize that there are these stereotypes that are bad.
Well, I think Huckleberry Finn's a great sort of example of this, right?
Yeah.
Was Twain not as progressive as we might like him to be today, right? If Huckleberry Finn was published, today, would we have very, very different problems with it than at the time? Of course. At the same time, to sort of recognize that Twain was really progressive at the time in what he was doing, right? And I think you're right. Does he infantilize Jim in some ways? He does, certainly. At the same time, Twain was really sort of pointing out the fundamental problem of racism in the culture, right? That he is not as progressive as we would like him today, though. There are some people who make the argument of, well, we should either remove that word, that offensive word, from the book. And of course, they did publish a version of Huckleberry Finn a number of years ago that removed that word. Or even further, we should not teach that book anymore. Students should not have to read that book anymore because it's problematic. And, I think when we do that, it erases the reality of the past. Right?
Well, that's kind of the second mode that Snyder mentions, a little different from that, and I'd like to hit on that briefly if we could, but then go on to the third, which I think is a very difficult concept that Snyder offers. But the second mode in which truth dies, Snyder says, is shamanistic incantation, or the repetition of name calling, in which we label things. Now, that fits a little bit with Twain, because what was happening there was the stereotyping with a labeling by stereotype. If you would. So that was kind of, it may have been true for that individual, but certainly for a race, it does not comport with reality, for instance. So it was in a sense a fictional counter world. But make a comment if you would about labeling and how we create a counter world through labeling, and truth dies, as Snyder says, through labeling.
It's funny, the term that I sort of think of that gets thrown around a whole lot lately, really in the past couple of years more than ever, it seems to me, is the term fascist. And again, we see this on sort of both sides, where you have certain segments of the left that say, Trump is a fascist, Republicans are fascist, right? If they want to call Richard Spencer a fascist, great. He's a neo-Nazi, so call him a fascist if you want. But the sort of notion that, well, Republicans are all fascist. The other side is, people talk about, the tyranny of the left, the fascism of the left. And again, this is a fascinating term because, you know, a fascist is a very, very specific thing. And I think, you know, there's a grand loosening of the usage of that term. But at the same time, I mean, to call someone a fascist is to totally shut down discussion again, right? Because if you say, well, that position is fascist, well, any discussion about it, if you say, well, maybe that's not fascist, then the retort is, well, then you're a fascist too, or you sympathize with fascism, right? I mean, we saw this after September 11th, you know, the notion of, well, you're either a patriot or you're a sympathizer with terrorism, as if being opposed to the war in Iraq automatically made you a sympathizer with terrorism. So we think about how, you know, language there has been a radical shift in language. Again, I think it goes down to the sound bites. It takes a lot more time to really dissect someone's political and policy positions than just to say, oh, well, you're a fascist, and attempt to sort of shut it down there. And so I think that sort of labeling has become really, really dangerous. And again, it serves to really push us politically and culturally further apart, because again, you cannot have a discussion with a genuine fascist. And so again, I think that is a grossly overused term, but that is often more used simply to shut down any sort of discussion.
Well, I think that if you look back at the history of our country, we are excellent at labeling.
Yeah.
At labeling groups, at labeling individuals, Don.
I think it may be a human trait, but that's neither. Although I would suggest, by the way, that and certainly for poetry, I don't know about prose, but for poetry, repetition of words and ideas as part of it's what makes poetry particularly very, very effective.
Tremendously
powerful. It's right. The power of rhetoric, I guess yep. It is, right?
But this is why, you know, I mean, we think about Trump's labels.
Right.
Crazy so-and-so, right? Or loony so-and-so, right? That he keeps repeating it over and over again because it becomes this very easy sort of soundbite.
Right. And by utilizing those terms, the derogatory, like Crooked Hillary, for example, it creates it in not more than a couple of words, he creates an entire narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, and that's one of the things about modern politics today is when we think about the kinds of words that are being used, and particularly from the president, who tends to try to find words and phrases. I mean, there's a conscious effort to then go out and fight his opponents. So, for example, he describes the investigation into Russia as a witch hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he purposely, and I understand from the report, he purposely thought about it and said, yeah, this is what I want to do. I'm going to repeat this over and over and over and over again. And then after a while, he gets absorbed by his supporters, maybe some other people. So now he's been able to describe and to discredit whatever it is that's coming out of the Mueller report. I think they're having a little more difficult time, I think, with now that the Mueller report is out.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see them trying to do the same kind of thing. Well, they didn't find any collusion, even though collusion was not actually an issue of the report.
Right.
And it doesn't say anything about
that. Nor is
it
actually a crime.
Right.
Conspiracy is the crime, yeah.
So it lacks, right, but by utilizing that term, saying, well, there's no collusion, he simplifies and creates a narrative for then people who support him.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, by the way, and you talk about this, but the idea about things that are counterintuitive. So we are told that we should take the president figuratively, not literally.
Right.
Okay, well, what does that mean, right? So that means, well, if he says something that's not true, it's okay because its message is true.
Right. Feels true.
It feels
right. Right. It feels true.
Well, the problem problem with lies is that they are meant to deceive. Mm-hmm. And the other problem with lies is that we generally act on the information that people give us. And that's crucially important because if what you are told, the information you receive is true, your actions that follow from that may well be somewhat positive for the culture or for the society. If you are lied to and you act on that lie, then it is quite possible that harm could be done to the culture and done to you, because the lie does not comport with the experience that you're having in the real world out there. Let me go to the third way anyway that Snyder says, and this kind of feeds all together, and that is that truth dies in the open embrace of contradiction. Are we experiencing today in our culture, and look at it beyond politics, in the educational field, in science, in media, are we experiencing an open embrace of contradiction today, where contradiction does not seem to matter?
Well, I mean, it strikes me that when you talk to Trump supporters, I was able to talk to some, up to a number of them actually, and you know, you say, well, you know, the president said that Mexico was going to build a wall, and the response is, well, I knew that it probably wasn't going to happen, or well, the wall hasn't been built. Well, I knew it probably wasn't going to happen, but I believe him anyway. I mean, he's my guy. So even though he has said something that's not true, they take it, they step back, and they sort of accept the idea that, well, he's telling them something that they want to hear. And that they obviously also, by the way, in a rally, can participate in. So when he says, who's going to build a wall, and everybody says Mexico, there's a participatory quality to that event, even though most people probably in the rally realize that, no, Mexico's probably not going to build a wall, and no, the wall, whatever that may mean, it will, may not very well be built either. So I think there's this acceptance of the idea that political figures, more than ever now, can say a lot of things that aren't true, and then people go ahead and they accept it, knowing that it's not true. It seems as if that's more true today than it maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, when we think of presidents and political figures as being at least more tethered to the truth, and that they've something, if they say something that's not true, that they apologize, for example. And this particular president does not apologize for, I can't think of anything that he said that is not true. He just simply doubles down and asks him not to be overly critical of the person who supports Donald Trump. It's just, that's his mode of operation. So in that sense, I think we can see this issue where, yes, people know that what is being said is not true, but they believe in this man anyway. And I think that probably moves to what we were talking about, tribalism, which will identify with him. He's expressing an outrage that I feel. He may not be saying exactly the right things, or he might not be saying something that's accurate, but he's saying something that I feel that must get out. And I think that, and there's a lot of reasons for why that might be, but nonetheless, I think that from a Trump supporter, I think that's exactly what's happening.
Well, that is exactly what you just raised, is exactly Snyder's fourth point, which is he calls misplaced faith. Hmm. That is, you put your confidence in a poor individual or place. But let me go back to the embrace of contradiction, and that Don, yours was a good political example, and it also follows the president saying, you know, I alone can solve it. Well, we know nobody acts alone in this world. But Adam, in the educational world, is there any kind of sense that there is an embrace of contradiction, that you see it all among your students in the academic world?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've really seen on college campuses is the notion about freedom of expression. Right, where we have the idea that university is a place where we are students, faculty alike are supposed to be engaging in difficult discussions, right? Coming to understand different perspectives, different rhetorical approaches, different ideologies, in terms of trying to arrive at some higher sense of truth, right? And in doing that, right, in order to sort of work towards that goal, very often we have to encounter ideas that we very much disagree with, right? That's sort of part of the educational process. And yet you see on many college campuses today attempts to silence the free expression of others with whom students often disagree, right? They may see those beliefs as, fundamentally flawed, and therefore those individuals should have no right to speak, right? So again, we can think of, the obvious easy examples are your Richard Spencers, your Milo Yiannopoulos, figures who see themselves as just out there to push people's buttons, right? But this has also occurred with less far-right individuals, right? Simply individuals who are not touting a certain far-left sort of party line. And so that you've had student protest against even sort of what we might think of as traditional liberals in the sort of the classic sense of it, where because they are, I think of Steven Pinker, right, who we mentioned a number of shows ago, I think when we were talking about free speech generally, Steven Pinker, who is no right winger, right, is no Trump supporter, but because he is complicating certain ideas that are very popular amongst students right now in terms of identity politics or social justice, there are students who will protest even him coming to speak on campus, despite the fact that his academic qualifications are impeccable in many ways. And so I think that there is a very interesting contradiction that on the one hand, we want to promote voices on college campuses, but also only if they are certain kinds of voices.
Well, one of the things I would say is that I think what's happened, particularly for those people who left or who are progressive circles or whatever, who adhere to this idea, two things. One is obviously they see the protest obviously is a form of free speech.
Right.
But I think they're also looking at speech, and this is something, as something is more than, and these ideas is more than just simply ideas, mm-hmm. that they actually carry out things and actions in society which are detrimental to society in general, but obviously detrimental to himself. For example, the extreme example would be as if you had somebody, from the Ku Klux Klan, for example, right? Where they view these are not just simply words, but they're incitement, right? So we have that problem. In the United States, it's really interesting, because in the United States, we have this almost fundamentalist view of free speech, right? The Skokie is a classic example where the neo-Nazis were going to march through a Jewish community. The court said, no, you can do it, right? And because all you can do is time, place, and manner. You can't judge it on content, even though it was incendiary. So we have a fundamentalist view of it. On the other hand, is that by marching through that, were they doing more than actually expressing free speech? Was that speech being turned into something else that we can't really quite evaluate? It's not quite, is it yelling, fire in a crowd of theater? What is it?
Right.
So, and I think, particularly for speech, I think that's one of the fundamental problems I think we're constantly running into. And I think it's one of the problems I think you run into as an educator as well, is this idea that they're looking at free speech not as just simply an open dialogue, but as an act in and of itself.
We're always very good at analyzing the problem and the issue. Snyder, unfortunately, we don't have time. These responses to the post-truth culture could be an hour or more's discussion in their own. But in concluding our program, let me offer at least three responses that we might offer. One, he says, is believe in truth. And he suggests that if nothing is true, then all is spectacle. And that would be an hour's discussion itself, right, in terms of what
the next
spectacle
episode
is. The second from him is define institutions, defend institutions. He suggests it is institutions that help us preserve decency. And then the last one he suggests is stand out. And I interpret this to be a symbol of resistance to the lying, a resistance to the lying that does not comport with reality. Well, let me return to Yeats and his poem, The Second Coming. This is not a religious poem. I would suggest that it is a moral poem. Remember, the poem was written in 1919, immediately following the devastating and bewildering experience of the First World War. There was the overwhelming sense that nothing would ever be the same, that the center would not hold. Something horrible in humanity had been unleashed by this war. Something, its gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, its hour come round at last, was slouching forward to be born. Yeats probably did not know exactly what that was in 1919. But I would suggest that in his prescience, he knew the beast was coming. And in his day, it turned out to be Nazi Germany. What is the center that holds our diverse society together? Again, I would suggest that it is commitment to objective truth and its traveling companion, reason. Will this center hold? It's an interesting question today. On our third and last program on truth, we'll talk about truth and politics and what it will take for the center to hold. Thanks to our guests, Don Rush and Adam Wood. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.